always be something alluring about the great outdoors. Maybe it's a primal urge. Maybe it's a reaction to this modern life. Whatever it is, travellers will always want to get outside and enjoy what nature has to offer. They'll always glory in the feeling of being amid forests, mountains, oceans and beaches. There's just something about the outdoors that a city could never match. There's a feeling of freedom, a feeling of adventure. It recharges your batteries. It reconnects you with what's good about the world. Sometimes it's a little scary. Sometimes it's lonely. But it's always memorable. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today, we're heading into the great outdoors. We're getting into the wild. We're talking about all the best experiences you can have in the natural world, all the places to go and the amazing things to do. And we'll also discuss a few things to avoid. Helping me do that are two passionate advocates for adventure in this big wide world. First up, she's a travel writer, editor, and influencer whose passion for the outdoors begins right here in Australia, Georgia Rickard.
Hello.
Hey, Georgia.
Thanks
great
for
to have you.
Me.
Also with us today, he's a travel writer and adventurer who has covered this planet's outdoor attractions from pole to pole, David McGonigal. Hi, David.
Hi, guys.
Thanks so much for coming along. Now, first up, guys, how do you feel about camping? Because I wanted to dedicate this entire episode to camping, and Annie, our producer, told me that I couldn't because it's too niche. Am I the only one who really loves it? What's the story there?
I don't think it's niche at all. In fact, we were just talking this morning, think everyone should take their young family camping, just so the kids know what camping's like, and work out if they want to do it as they get older. Because a lot of people are just excluded from it and never get a chance to kind of wake up in the wilds. And it's, apart from the fact that it's really affordable, you need a tent and preferably a sleeping bag.
Yep. Some sort of car to get you in and out.
Yeah. And so you don't need much.
Yeah.
And you wake up in the most amazing places in the world that you'd be paying hundreds of dollars for if there was a hotel where you happened to have put your tent.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I found that my love of camping has increased as I've gotten older. I don't remember particularly liking it when I was a kid. It's just a thing that we got dragged along to do. But Georgia, what's your position on camping? You seem like a camper to me.
Mate, look. Camping was never really my bag growing up.
Okay.
Here is my analogy. I've been thinking about this one.
Okay.
I feel like it's a lot like Zumba workouts. Right? You
that
go,
was unexpected.
Yes. Well, just stick with me.
Okay.
You go and, you know, you hate it. You hate everything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You hate the other people that are doing it. You hate getting into the class. You hate the smell. It's just, you resist it. And then as soon as you start doing it.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it gets really good. And then the longer you do it, the more you like it.
I kind of agree with you, actually. I do love camping, but the first night or two of camping, I think to myself, did I really like this thing? Like, it's, you can't get clean. There's dirt everywhere. You can't stand up in your tent to get changed.
Can I just change and add one or two words? Tented safaris. African tented safaris.
Right.
Where I've stayed under canvas in Africa.
Yep.
Where my tent had a freestanding marble bathroom.
Wait, that is not camping. That's glamping.
Glamping.
And I'm all for that, but that does not count.
We're talking down and dirty camping.
Yeah.
And first couple of days, it's not that comfortable or fun, but then I find I'm the same as you, Georgie. I really get into it. I love it after a little while. I've spent 6 months of my life in a row camping and didn't
That's
really
disgusting.
I didn't get bored of it. I enjoyed it. Although I did like rent the odd room here and there, I suppose, like if I was being...
We did a motorcycle ride across Siberia and we got to the stage where we'd stop at truck stops and the truckies would say, hey, it looks like you guys are doing it rough. And we thought,
right.
The Siberian truck driver saying we're looking pretty rough. It's time to book into a hotel and
Absolutely.
Have a shower.
But it is that real connection with the outdoors, isn't it? Because, you're sleeping with the thinnest possible walls you can have. You're lying on the ground usually or close to. You can hear all those rustles and roars and chirps from around you. Aside from just sort of sleeping in the under the stars, it's your closest connection that you can get.
You know, I actually I did this epic 3-week camping trip through the Kimberley along the Gibb River Road, and it was amazing because when you're so far out in nature without phone reception or really any devices that you can connect to, you do get that sense of peace that kind of settles into your bones, and you just feel calm. It's beautiful, but that being said, at the very end of the Gibb River Road is a beautiful place called El Cuestro, which is a 6-star luxury lodge. And when I had my first shower there, I was so happy I cried.
I've done the same camping in Nepal, and then you come back down into Kathmandu.
Yeah.
And we actually got into a crowded lift, and we hadn't realised how we smelt until we noticed the crowd in the lifts reaction
thinning out very
to
quickly.
Us.
All of a sudden jabbing
and
all
then,
the buttons
yeah,
to
and
get
then,
out.
And
yeah.
then the power went out when I got to my room. So it was only the next morning I actually looked and saw the bath was brown, just with the dirt that had
yeah,
washed off
right.
my body.
Yeah, yep. Oh, there is a bit of that. But, you know, you learn to embrace it after a while. Yeah. But let's, okay, we've touched on glamping. Let's talk about some of the other ways to enjoy the great outdoors. There's luxury, isn't there? You can do this thing in style. I've stayed in some pretty amazing places in Botswana and Namibia and, you know, really beautiful. I mean, they're called tents officially, but they have wooden floorboards. They have these amazing bathrooms, as you said.
And they're permanent structures,
really,
aren't
they? And they're permanent structures as well. You must have seen a few of those, David.
I have, and they're beyond luxurious. I can't think of any kind of solid building that actually compares with some of the places like Londolosi and some of the Great Plains things. They're just incredible rooms.
Yeah. I stayed at a place called Loisaba in Kenya, and they have what they call star beds, which is basically they have a sort of permanent cabin type thing up in the hills there. And the bed is on wheels. And so at night they wheel the whole bed out onto the balcony and put a mosquito net over the top of it. And so you sort of climb in and you can see this blanket of stars above you, and you sort of feel like you're just sleeping out in the outdoors.
I hate to break it to you, but that sounds a lot like a swag on wheels.
Much, much more expensive than that.
And I'll tap into something else you said there with the stars. Like, my wife had never been camping until she met me.
Right.
She was more kind of a Gucci backpack, if they exist, sort of traveler.
Hilton hippie, I used
That's
to call
it.
My brother.
Yeah. And and I really wanted to take her camping. And the one thing she loved is the concept of being out in the darkness, looking at the stars, looking at the Milky Way in the Australian outback.
Yeah.
So that's what we did, and we actually went camping. And because she could just sit outside and look at the stars, camping became this amazingly surreal, beautiful experience for her, ignoring the dirt, the insects,
the bugs,
everything else.
Georgie, you must have stayed in some pretty fancy places, haven't you, around the traps?
Do you know, you were actually talking about the Australian outback, and I was thinking about Longitude 131, which is, of course, Uluru's famous glamp site where Kate and Wills have stayed and where Oprah's stayed. And that to me is definitely up there as a highlight glamping experience. You know, it was one of the first in the world. And each time I go, it's more and more special. You know, obviously it's in the last 15 years since they've opened, they've made several upgrades to it. But
does it feel like an outdoors experience, or does it feel more like a sort of pampering experience?
It's definitely a pampering experience.
I mean, it could be both, though.
That's it. And the thing about that is that I think you really do kind of get the best of both worlds, particularly in a place like Uluru, where what's around you is right in your face. I mean, you can't escape it even when you step indoors. So to be able to have that right there, literally in front of your bed as you wake up in the mornings, and, you know, the blinds pull back to reveal the rock right in front of you.
Yeah.
But then still have, you know, a personal butler and a gorgeous selection of wines from all around Australia. I mean, it's a delicious way to camp. I'm not going to lie.
Camp. We're doing camp with inverted commas here, aren't we?
My mum's actually really frustrated at the idea that I have done more glamping experiences than she has, because the way she sees it, glamping is something that you're supposed to graduate to when you're older.
Right.
But
having done a lot of normal camping trips beforehand, rather than going straight to the glamping.
Indeed.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, what about accommodation aside, how do you guys like to enjoy the outdoors when you travel? Is hiking a major thing for you, David? Is that the best way to do
it? That's kind of the purest form, but you're really limited in how far you can get.
Yeah.
But I did the Camino in Portugal this year, and walking the Camino, and people say, what's it like walking the Camino? I said, when you get up in the morning, all you have to do is walk.
Right.
And that makes life so simple.
Yeah.
You just walk, you find somewhere to have lunch,
so this
you
is
keep
the,
walking.
The Camino to Santiago. Yeah. Obviously, I guess the most popular route is through Spain.
Well,
through
France
Northern Spain.
Into Spain, yeah.
Yeah, but you were going through Portugal.
Yeah, we did the Portuguese one. There's numerous. There's some that start in Italy. They start everywhere.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Many other people on there? Is it a solitary experience?
Oh, no. I think it was a solitary experience 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There's now literally, I think, hundreds of thousands converging from all directions.
Yeah.
But
you enjoyed the sort of long-term nature of it, the get up and walk?
Yeah, because you are just getting up and walking and walking 25 kilometres a day.
Yep.
Walking is actually your main activity for the day.
Yeah, right.
So it's not a kind of, I might just check my emails and wonder how things are going.
Yep.
You don't have time for it. You're just literally in your own head.
Yeah.
Which is probably the reason why everyone says it. becomes a spiritual experience. Even if you say, I'm doing the Camino because I want some exercise, you end up thinking, this is spiritual because I've just got so much time to think.
Yeah, it'd be sort of meditative after a while, I suppose.
So I think the walking's kind of the perfect, purest way, I said, of doing it. For me, motorcycling's kind of the ideal, because you can actually cover some distance.
Yep.
You've still got kind of wind in the face. It's kind of, you're outdoors, you're with the elements. When it's raining, you've got the rain on you.
Yep.
Not just kind of, you're not sheltered inside a
It's the
a,
smells
a vehicle
as well that you get on a bike, which you don't get when you're in a car or a bus or a train or something.
Yeah, you're
like
just
that.
Exposed to literally everything.
Yeah. I find you know, when you're driving past the ocean, you smell the salt. You know, when you there's always things that you don't realize that
You're stuck behind a truck, you smell the diesel.
Exactly. Yeah. How about you, Georgia? What's your favourite way of experiencing? Are you a hiker?
Yeah, look, I was actually just reflecting on what you were saying then, David, about hiking being the purest form, and how that trip was unfortunately not a solitary activity because you're surrounded by so many other people. And I actually, only a couple of months ago, jumping from one rock to another, hiked up the world's biggest rock. Now, most people think that is Uluru, but it's actually in Western Australia. It's quite little known. It's a place called Mount Augustus. It looks a lot like Uluru, but it's 2.5 times bigger. It's 800 million years old.
So how does that work? Is it a monolith? Is it a single rock?
It's a monocline. Now, don't quiz me any more than that.
We've reached the limit of your...
That's the limit of my knowledge.
All right.
I can... I can add to that, actually. There's one thing I can add to that. It's bloody hard to climb up.
Right.
But in line with what you were saying, David, I think it really does strip away so much. And also, when you're in kind of a state of discomfort or pain, I think you...
We're trying to be encouraging people to go into
Well, I mean, no. I mean, like, a strenuous exercise or when you physically challenge yourself, it really... I mean, what an incredible form of travel, right? Mm. Because then you come back to your everyday life and you've pushed past limits that you thought that you had, and then you can take those lessons and apply it to, you know, your world back in the city. What a beautiful way to...
Yeah.
To experience the world.
And I agree with David. I have found it quite oddly meditative, those long hikes over several days. I've done a bit in the Andes in Peru, and you know, it's a challenge every day, and you sort of start off thinking about your surroundings and taking all this amazing stuff in, but after a while it's just one foot off in front of the other and plod along.
There's also something called the Antarctic syndrome, where a lot of people who go to Antarctica are quite elderly,
right,
and they haven't walked anywhere apart from in a mall for probably decades,
right,
and then they get to Antarctica and they're walking along beaches, they're walking up glaciers, things like that, and they suddenly realize they're nowhere near as incapacitated as they think they are. And Georgia said, you go back home with this renewed, it's a 10-kilometer walk. Instead of thinking, oh my God, 10 kilometers, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You're thinking, 10 kilometers, that was nice. I remember that.
Yeah, right.
I'll do that again.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Another amazing walks that I've done is walking safaris in Africa, particularly in Kenya, where it's a completely different experience, where you get out of the Jeep or the normal safari vehicle, and you spend a day walking through these places where you know there are rhinos, you know there are lions and all these things out there, and you've just got a guide who's got a gun. And it's such an amazing experience to connect you to everything that landscape has to offer, and all the dangers and all the excitement. I absolutely love it.
A friend of mine takes walking tours for polar bears.
Oh,
out
yeah.
Of Churchill. And he said every day you really know you're alive, because your reactions and your knowledge of polar bears and their behaviour is the only thing that keeps the group alive.
Yeah, right.
I thought there's a challenge.
Because even when you're in a vehicle, even when you're in Manitoba or when you're in Africa or something like that, there's an element of safety or an element of the fact that you're kind of a viewer. You know, you're a spectator, but as soon as you're on two feet walking around, you're part of it. You're in there. If something decides to attack, it can attack. You can't drive away.
You're making me think about the Australian classic Tracks. You know, the book that was written in the 70s, the coming of age, where the woman walks through the Simpson Desert over 30 days, and she talks about how over time she actually starts to lose her sense of personal boundary and really just become one with the landscape, which sounds, you know, pretty spiritual and a bit, you know, ridiculous, I suppose, to anyone living in a city.
Yeah.
But she also goes into a bit about Pitjantjatjara, which is the language group that I have completely mispronounced in the central APY lands of Australia, and how they, when they speak, their language has no verb for is. Everything right. only exists in relation to each other. And so coming back to this idea that you really start to become part of the landscape, you're not separate to it.
Yeah.
And I think when you do spend, you know, time out in a walking safari for an extended period, you can't help but start to really attune to everything around you so much more.
Yeah.
And it's just such a nice way to slow down, if
yeah,
nothing
absolutely.
Else.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of a survival mechanism, I guess, because you're constantly thinking about not being eaten by something. Intrepid Travel's range of active and trekking trips takes in some of the most famous outdoor scenery on the planet. Kilimanjaro, Patagonia, Annapurna, the Rockies. But that doesn't mean they aren't suited to an inexperienced hiker. All you need is a sturdy pair of shoes, a bit of pre-trip training, and the best guides in the business. That's where Intrepid Travel comes in. Start planning your outdoor adventure at intrepidtravel.com/active. How about driving, though, as well? Driving can be great. I love a road trip, and it's a great way of experiencing, as David, as you were saying, with your motorbike, you get to see a lot more, cover a lot more distance, see a lot more different things. Georgia, you've just been driving around the south of Western Australia, haven't you, on a pretty incredible trip.
I have, yeah. I've been lucky enough to do several trips around WA recently, and that state in particular is so under-recognised for its general levels of epicness. Like, half the state is still dirt tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
People just, there's yep. just, you know,
there's
no,
out there.
It's, no, there's stuff well, out there.
No one, should I say.
There are people, though, yeah. as well. It's just, you know, a lot bigger stations, a lot more time, a lot more distance,
yeah.
and, oh, it's just a, it's just a whole other world that when you're embroiled in the city landscape,
yeah.
you're not across. But road trips for me are my favourite way to travel.
Yep.
You like bicycles
or motorcycles. Yeah.
But,
yeah, I remember in a caravan park one time having a conversation with some English people who were saying there's just so many spectacular things in Australia, but they're just so far apart. And
yeah.
as an Australian, it was really hard to say it's the stuff between them that makes it special. And, and when you're driving, particularly through the desert, you just see those fine variations.
Mm-hmm.
And each night you stay in a completely different environment where you woke up in the morning if
right.
you're just crossing the Simpson Desert or the Nullarbor or whatever,
yeah.
but you don't, you have to really be attuned to actually see how it unfolds in front of you. It's not, it's not obvious. You have to be involved to get stuff out of it.
But don't you think that's kind of the beauty of that kind of, I mean,
absolutely.
If everybody did more of that travel, how much happier and calmer and more peaceful would the world be, right? Because you wouldn't just be hopping from city to, you know, from banger to banger to spectacular to, from postcard to postcard. You'd actually be slowing down, stopping, appreciating, a lot more grateful. The whole world could benefit from that.
My personal favourite mode of transport at the moment is the scooter. I've done a few trips getting around on a scooter, which is kind of like David's motorbiking adventures, but on a much smaller and slower scale. I would love to graduate to real grown-up motorbikes at one point. But at the moment, just little scooters. I've driven around the Mekong Delta on a scooter, around Sicily on a scooter, and it's such an amazing way to, you know, it forces you to slow down in a way. It forces you to go on back roads because you don't want to go on a highway in one of those things. You see a lot of territory, but you also get to really experience it, as we've been saying. You know, the rain comes down and it hits you. You see a storm when you're out in the Mekong Delta building up on the horizon. You're like, I need to get into some shelter really quickly.
Hot damn.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I loved it.
I bet.
Yeah, it really connects you to the environment, which, David, you must have felt on a number of times in your motorbiking adventures.
Yeah, but when you're on a bike, a large motorcycle, you're kind of a bit limited. The first time I did my first trip around the world, I met a guy that was traveling around on a 50cc tiny little Honda.
Wow.
And when little he got bored with the bike, he used to just take it on the bus.
Right.
I thought, that works.
Not so easy with a BMW touring
No,
bike,
not so much, no. The driver tends to complain.
There must be quite a community when, I mean, you know, when you're backpacking, or for example, and you sort of tap into this traveling community. I know that there's certainly something similar with a biking community as in push bike. So I imagine there's probably a motorcycling community that is kind of quite nomadic, traveling around the world. Did you find that when you were biking around the world that you met similar people or with similar missions?
Completely. And a lot of us still stay in touch. There is actually a worldwide motorcycle community, particularly for people who have done really long rides, where you all just stay in touch with each other.
Do you travel with each other for a few days if you meet up with someone on the road?
Yeah, sometimes you meet
and
stay with them. Yeah. So particularly on that first ride, which was kind of decades ago, there weren't that many people out doing it. But even now, I remember one time being down in the bottom part of Argentina, and there was some other motorcyclists, so we stopped and talked to them. And then some other motorcyclists arrived and stopped. And we ended up with about 15 bikes stopped on this street corner down the bottom of South America, just talking about where we're going, where we'd come from, where to stay, the whole thing. It's so much a community.
Yeah, right. Does the outdoors to you guys, does it mean wildlife? I mean, you must have had some pretty amazing experiences with wildlife. Georgia, I know you were diving with minke whales in the Great Barrier Reef or something.
Yes.
I mean, that doesn't even sound like it could be a real thing.
I know, and I tell you what. So there's actually a really fantastic backstory to that. So there's a group of a subspecies of minke whales, dwarf minke whales, that congregate every year on the Great Barrier Reef. Typically in June is their kind of peak season. And for a long time, there were rumours of this strange-looking, really friendly whale that was approaching scuba divers.
Right.
No one could actually pin down what it was or even what it looked like. And then one local in the 80s was diving, saw one of the whales, was like, oh, I know exactly what this is, got out, sketched down what he saw immediately, and from that, science was actually able to recognise that there was a new kind of whale there.
Right.
And today...
And this is this dwarf minke whale.
Yes. So they're completely protected. You're not allowed to approach them in the water, but because they're so friendly, an industry has sprung up around boats travelling north, you know, 3 days north of Cairns, and you jump in the water 100 metres, you know, distance from the whales, and they will actually not only come over, but they'll bring over their calves and they'll come right up to you, and they're quite small, you know, sort of, we're talking, I think it's eight feet or 8 metres, one or the other, I can't remember anymore because I was in
quite
such
different.
Awe. Well, it's hard, everything under the water is so magnified.
That's true, yeah.
But they come right up to you and they just look at you in the eye. I mean, that's the thing that I remember most, was just coming face to face with this curious, calm intelligence. And I remember the first time I locked eyes with one of them, I got out of that boat and I cried. It was a life-changing moment for me.
Yeah, there aren't that many experiences, wildlife experiences like that are so natural and yet so close. And I mean, David, one gorillas that you've done in Rwanda must be sort of a similar experience.
Yeah, and that was about a year ago, and I still remember every minute of that. And particularly when we arrived in our first group, there was another kind of rogue male kind of in the background, and so the alpha male of the group was to decide to chase him off.
Yep.
And the only thing that was standing between them was me.
Right.
So I actually had the alpha male run over my foot.
Really?
While he was kind of chasing after him.
Yeah,
and
right.
It was just this huge
presence. That is a
close
encounter.
But when you look at them, you're looking at such intelligent beings. It's not like he's going to be annoyed with me being there. He had one course, I was kind of irrelevant to that.
Yeah,
so he
right.
was just kind of brushing past me. But the rest of the time when you're just sitting there looking at them, they're looking at you. They know you're there for an hour.
Yeah, right.
Apparently, actually, if you actually overstay, they just kind of get up and leave because they know the hour's
up. Point their watches.
That's it. Yeah, sorry. That's it. Union, we're out.
Yeah.
And as Georgia says, it's that look into another creature's eyes and seeing intelligence looking back at you is such a remarkable experience. And if that's the only reason to go into the outdoors, that should get everyone out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, don't you find that to be the biggest conundrum? Like, I want to tell everybody to go and do these experiences, but at the same time, you don't want these mass crowds going. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of the...
Yeah, I mean, something like the gorillas, it's very tightly controlled, isn't it, with the amount of people that can go into the forest each day, the amount of time that you spend with
the animals.
And when
there are crowds,
they
just doubled the price to something ludicrous.
Yeah, right. It's about $1,500 or
something. $1,500 US for an hour.
Yeah, right. It's a lot of money.
Yep.
But worth it.
But absolutely worth it in terms of life experiences.
Yeah. What about when things go wrong out in the outdoors? Because that is a thing that does happen occasionally. My closest ever brush with death was an outdoors experience in Thailand, where I was hiking through a jungle and dived into a rock pool to swim up to a waterfall, and ended up being in the water with a 2-meter-long king cobra, which was very close enough to strike me. Basically, had risen up in the water and was giving me the last signal before it struck. And I would have died a fairly horrific death in a Thai jungle somewhere. You know, these are the things that people worry about if they're not used to the great outdoors. And things do go wrong, don't they? I mean, you guys, you must have had things that have
great
happened.
Outdoors for me, I guess the
you've
the
been
bad
chased
experiences.
By various bears.
Yeah, been chased by most bears, actually, it seems, at one stage or another. But I remember, again, back to the motorcycling, the road was impassable, the back wheel jammed, which actually caused the clutch to burn out. I was right in the middle of central Afghanistan.
Right.
We'd been told that the roads were probably going to be closed for the next 4 months as winter moved in.
Yep.
The guide actually said, "Do you have a revolver for the wolves?"
Wow.
Which is a bit too close to the great outdoors. And then that night I found out I was in the middle of a hepatitis relapse. I'd got hepatitis in Kathmandu, so I was I was sick, the bike was broken, the road was impassable.
Yeah.
And then that was the time when I realized an adventure is just a disaster that you walk away from.
And, that is beautifully put.
And then the next morning we woke up, the road had, it was blue skies, the road had actually firmed up, the bike hadn't miraculously fixed itself, we managed to tow it into a town and then pack the clutch with cardboard packing case, actually. And all turned out well. But at the time, you're out there knowing there was probably no way out.
Yeah, right. Wow, that is a, I mean, that's when you know you're alive, I suppose.
For a while,
for a little
anyway.
While, yeah. When you have a tenuous grasp on it. Georgia, how about you?
Do you know, you were talking and it was reminding me of a time when I was hiking through Nicaragua and I stopped in at this town on the beach and got chatting to a stranger at a cafe. It was the wet season, so there was really no one around. Not a good time to go to Central America. He was the only person that spoke English, and we got chatting, and he said that there was a beach nearby where they'd filmed Survivor.
Right. Okay.
And I thought, oh, that sounds fantastic. And he was like, well, do you want to go? Literally, like, most of the businesses were closed. You couldn't really take tours.
These are all the
classic
tourist mistakes, aren't they? There's like several large alarm bells going off right now.
I mean, the fact that it was the beach where Survivor was filmed probably should have been an indication that it wasn't going to be a particularly safe place or very close to civilization.
Yeah.
Anyway, we jumped in a car, which oddly he had. I didn't question it. We had to cross something like 20 different rivers and streams to get to this beach. And when we finally made it there, there was this half-finished construction zone, and construction had stopped because it was the wet season.
Mm-hmm.
But there were two security guards there with guns. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And he was like, the guy I was with was like, oh, don't worry about them. Anyway, we went for a swim, and literally we'd been there for about 10 minutes and it started to rain. And that was okay. We thought, oh, well, we'll just wait for the rain to stop. We, you know, started chatting, made conversation, kept raining, started raining a little more, rained and rained. The last river that we'd crossed started to kind of rise. And I didn't realize it, but what was going to happen that night was the worst flash flood in Nicaragua in 20 years.
Wow.
Now, I had no clothes apart from my cozy, my thongs and a sarong. I had no food. We had no water. I had no mosquito repellent. I didn't know this guy. And then, as it was getting dark, the security guard started hissing at us to be quiet and hide. And these turtle egg poachers with big long machetes were stalking the beach trying to, you know, hunt for illegal eggs. And basically we were not to be seen, because if we were, we were possibly in a lot of danger. And I have never been more uncomfortable and afraid in my life. Did I survive? You'll never know.
Well, I mean, well done for making all the classic mistakes and living to tell the tale.
Thank you.
In a single outing. That's very impressive.
That is very impressive.
Thank you. I'll add it to my resume.
Now, guys, unfortunately, we are running out of time. But I wanted to ask you to finish off with what is the one outdoor experience that you know, has meant the most to you, and that you think every other traveller should also go out there and have at some point in their lives?
I think a picnic in Torres del Paine. A motorcycle ride in, had been really windy, the wind dropped down.
In Patagonia.
In Patagonia, in South America, on the Chilean side. And Torres del Paine is just spectacular, these sawtooth mountains. And the sun was just doing spectacular things over them while we were actually cooking on a barbecue in this campground.
Yep.
And it was just the perfect backdrop. It was the most remarkable setting I'd ever seen. And we badly overburnt the steaks because we just couldn't take our eyes off the scenery.
Oh, wow.
Nice. Very nice. Georgia, how about you?
Yeah, that's such a toughie. Look, it's hard to say my number one, but one thing that does really stand out for me is Mungo National Park.
Okay.
Now, that's in outback New South Wales. It's where, you know, the famous Mungo Lady and Mungo Man were found.
Mm-hmm.
There is evidence of Indigenous civilization there that dates back, you know, arguably 60,000 years, but a whole civilization. And the sand dunes are constantly shifting and uncovering all these different artifacts. They change every day, and it's the most incredibly spiritual place. And it's a place where I learned to have a lot of respect and love for all of Australian heritage and history and our land. So as an Australian in particular, mm-hmm. I think it's a very significant place, and it's World Heritage listed.
Yep. Fantastic. And mine would be to spend one night camping at a place called Third Bridge in Botswana, which is a campsite in the Okavango Delta. There's no fences or anything around it. You're just camping out in the wild. Elephants walk through the campsite. You can hear lions roaring in the middle of the night. And it's such an amazing connection to that area and such a feeling of adventure when you're out there. It's just you, in the dark, in the one you shine a torch out into the bushes, and there's all these sets of eyes reflected back at you, and it's just there's no other place like it, I don't think. David and Georgia, thank you so much for coming along. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Ben.
If you would like to follow Georgia's travels, she's on Instagram, Georgia Rickard. Check her out there. If you'd like to read stories by me or David, you can find them on traveller.com.au. And if you'd like to subscribe to Flight of Fantasy, we're on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. We'll see you next time on Flight of Fantasy.